Tune in to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM, and be part of an in-depth discussion on events you didn't know you needed to hear until you do, from Namibia, Africa, and around the world. Tune in from Monday to Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. only on Eagle FM.
Good afternoon. And welcome to a Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on Eagle FM. As always, this time of the day is your favorite duo here, keeping you company on your drive time show here on Eagle FM, keeping company whether you find yourself at home or at the office or on your way home or on your way to the office or wherever you are going. No judging. We're just glad you tuned in. And as usual, we have, what's that motto that we, at this point, I think it's safe to say that everyone knows that it's from DJ Khaled. Another one.
We had a motto?
No, the motto from DJ Khaled. Another one. We just do that Monday to Friday.
No, that was just poor DJ Khaled being, what's that thing's name? Being turned into a, it's not a meme, but... to be part of a meme.
Yeah, he also... you're right. He made it into the meme world where...
Or everyone made him a meme world.
Yeah. There's one meme that had a picture of DJ Khaled and, at the top, it was captioned, DJ Khaled. That's a nice song we have there. Mind if I yelled in it? We the best.
Indeed.
I know. So, now, let's talk about... workers. All workers.
Mm.
Yeah. And that's all workers. And by all workers, I mean all workers across all disciplines and workers all around the world. Because the International Court of Justice and the International Labour Organization have, something interesting they just put out that is making every employee, sort of like an every lawmaker, who's a UN member state, smile in a way that the International Court of Justice interpreted part of the, part of the International Labour Organization legislations that has been translated by a lot of employers at, as ambiguous, especially with regards to the right to strike. Now, the International Court of Justice decided to settle that storm, basically settle the debate over what that particular legislation from the International Labour Organization means by putting out something that is, something that is known as an advisory opinion. Look at it as a legal advice provided by the World Court, aka the International Court of Justice, to the United Nations, which is then dispensed or shared with all UN member states. So that in this case, because the discussion is about the workers' rights to strike, this of course has a lot of ripple effects with regards to the UN member states, especially in relations to the labor laws. That includes us. Now, the first question I asked myself is, why are we even having this conversation? The right to strike, we're debating whether or not that should be a right.
Well, Helmut, it's an interesting thing specifically because I read the summary that the ICJ had
put out.
Okay. Which was technically their motivation, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Their motivation is obviously based upon, firstly, like the panel of judges had to firstly identify whether or not they had any jurisdiction.
Yeah, that's where they always start.
Yeah, so whether they had any jurisdiction, and obviously they answered the question for the ILO's. What's the position? What's the position's name? Director General or something like that? The ILO's Director General or, their chief officer there to basically respond on the notion whether or not they can give an advisory opinion. Not, there was no case. Let us also be honest, dear listeners.
Yeah, no one sued anyone.
No one sued anyone in front of the ICJ. It was just that the ILO had a dispute. Was it since 2018 or 2019? internally because member nations were sort of like disputing this particular article within the ILO's particular makeup, you know, like its foundational sort of like charter, like the UN has a charter, a foundational document, like a constitution. The ILO supposedly also has something like this. And member nations were apparently disputing this particular aspect of the right to strike. Now, the interesting thing here is Namibia already, I will sort of like jump the gun already, Hamoud. We will satisfy that early enough. Namibia, according to the Ministry of Justice, confirmed that we do automatically, as Namibia, protect this particular right. The right for workers in any sort of like discussion, basically to down tools and to go and strike. You have the right. It's protected by the Constitution. However, obviously in the Namibia of today, it's always interesting for the rest of us Namibians. I specifically am always interested in specifically why people go and strike. In the scenario of, you know, okay, so what are the reasons that you are striking for? Is this based upon the cost of living issues? Is this based upon fuel prices becoming too expensive? Is this a discussion of, you know, one or other ministry creating one or other non-conducive or unconducive scenario in the broader economy, which technically has happened, or actually has come into play? Helmut, you would know because you're a cab, usual cab client or customer. Which is a scenario specifically not something that the employers created, rather, which is one of the few things specifically in a Namibian context where there are certain decisions that happen that has their direct implications or impact on the Namibian economy and specifically everyone else's particular pockets, if we use the word pocket. Now, I will mention one example from the start of this year, which was the workers of the start of this year's strikes that happened at Namib Mills, which was highly publicized. And I'll be honest with you, dear listeners, I tried reading up on some of that particular sort of like industrial action, and I just could not understand what was the actual basis for this particular striking, you know, worker strikes. The reasons that were given was because Helmut joined the company yesterday, but Helmut is more qualified than Dwight. Dwight has been there for 20 years. Dwight earns the salary. Helmut, who joined yesterday, has no worker experience, suddenly earns 5 times more than Dwight. I'll say it again. On such a scenario. Now,
that sounds pretty obvious.
It sounds pretty obvious, but let me ask you this, Helmut. If I don't have the certification or the education level, which is something with the lifelong learning discussion that we looked at from the ILO itself, where in the ILO's own research document it highlighted the more education or skills that employees have access to, the more it increases their opportunity, their ability to move and to access opportunities in the economy, right? Which is also the same statement that the NSA reiterated with the 2023 labor force survey, where they also said it clearly shows that Namibians who have continued or have advanced their education levels have the opportunity to have the ability to access more economic opportunities in the Namibian economy. Be that as it may, you now get down to a real world situation whereby the example that I just explained, which was one of the reasons given at that start of 2026 demonstration that I tried following, was what's actually going on here? So does this mean, Helmut, you've invested in education that costs a couple of $100,000 Namibian dollars? It's technically, you can't claim it back. There is no VAT claim back. You even pay VAT on that thing, ne?
Yeah.
Did you know that? When you studied, you paid VAT.
Well, technically, NASFA paid, you know, but thank you.
But you paid. I also paid. Yeah. I paid out of my pocket for myself.
Now, see, that I didn't
think about.
Yeah.
I didn't think about. Because it's value. It's value. Because technically, then, if you look at it in the broader economic sense, you know, you are part of the labor economy.
Yeah.
And obviously, the institution that you would have sought or, you know, accessed your higher education for, they are, you know, adding value to you by installing skills through the classes that you went to. But anyway.
Look, when you explain it that way, I
have to start it from there, because the argument that was positioned in that case study that I mentioned at the start of this year.
Yeah.
Look, there will always be people that will be unhappy about conditions that they find themselves in. It's a given. There's nothing that we can do. There's really nothing that we can do. And obviously also not everyone can be satisfied in many scenarios. However, when you read some of the articles that were put together based upon that specific strike, that specific legal action, you sit with the scenario of, okay, so this is a private company and what's really going on here? Because no one understands. I will tell you now, okay, not that I asked other people whether they understand, but when I sat there looking at the facts that were given by that journalist in that article, I was going like, is this the basis for really the whole factory, Downing Tools? There must be something else on, you know, afloat here, something that's not part of the discussion. And even the minister himself, Wise Emmanuel, tried, you know, sort of like mediating between the parties, between the company management and the labor union. But then we get into a real cost of living discussion, Helmut. For example, when you had to look at the teachers a few years back, before President Geingob passed away, where they approved the additional 8 or 7% for the teachers in the country? That was 2023.
Wait, now, is this the time when they went on strike?
They were threatening as well to go on strike. But their earnings, was literally locked in for like an 8-year, 10-year period. Now, if we take in consideration specifically the impact that COVID has had, the economic reclassification of Namibia at the start of Geingob's particular first term, which was 2015, start of 2015, end of 2014, where we got reclassified from an upper middle income country from a lower income, because it was now back in last year that we were reclassified back from upper to lower. Yeah, we were basically demoted. Yeah. But the demotion worked in our, technically, supposedly works in our favor.
It works in our favor, which is why we did not like the promotion.
The promotion, yeah. Promotion, actually, Helmut, was also a scenario that speaks well of the policies that Namibia wants to achieve. But here's the thing. One of the bare-bones statistics that the IMF and the World Bank looked at was the value of your economy. What activities was generating all this value? And from that assessment, they went like, oh, so in comparing Namibia to not just its neighbors, but other continental participants in this particular assessment, and looking at various particular sectors that Namibia dispenses regular funding support. So what I mean is, the budgets that the finance ministers announce at every year, what particular sectors get priority, and the priority sectors is always, that I'm now citing the former finance minister, Ipumbu Shimi, who cited that Namibia will not abandon the human capital investment that it does, meaning investing in education and investing in healthcare. So we know these particular facts on the ground, and we know that Namibia is in its own quiet form trying to achieve its particular developmental goals besides just the SDGs. However, within those developmental goals, Helmut, Are we staying in tandem with the affordability scenarios out there? Recently, I'm now citing yesterday and last week, some media publications, specifically even like ours of yesterday with the yesterday's The Villager platform, were looking into the affordability of homes. In the previous week's parliamentary sessions, okay, not the parliamentary session, let me take that out, but the Prime Minister himself has also taken notice of the affordability of a home and the affordability of a car. If a house of $1 million Namibian dollars is to be paid over 20 years, why is that the case? But a car of $1 million Namibian dollars worth has to be paid in 5 years. Has to be paid in 5 years. Yeah. In 5 years, you have to pay that million.
Yeah.
Ne? Now, yes, the scenario is the math is definitely not mathing in both products. For now, both products in comparison to both products.
You know, I found an article on social media where from one of the media houses here locally, where I just read through the article and everything, but I'm more interested in the comment sections of that, you know, of that article when it comes to subjects like that, because sort of like to some degree, minus all the sarcasm and all the, you know, you can easily tell by some of the comments that someone here is just, you know, either tipsy or drunk, one of the two.
Or just decided to wake up with the spice of life for that morning.
I did find one that I found very interesting, where one gentleman pointed out that what if this is a discussion of you know, different assets that we are talking about here? Because a house, that's a fixed asset, and you have a car, for example, which is not a fixed asset. And a fixed asset like a house or a piece of land is going to appreciate with time, and a car is going to depreciate with time. What if these differences in these legal differences and also different in appreciation and depreciation with time contributes to this the assessment with regards to the time period that you're required to pay off one, even though they have some of the same price?
Well, Helmut, here's the thing. The downside with a car is, if you look at a car, you are right on the depreciation factor, but take other things in consideration as well.
Yeah.
For example, here in the after South Africa's formal independence in 1994, between 1995 and 2015, car hijackings were ugly in South Africa. Now, obviously, the major retail banks in Namibia are definitely South African subsidiaries.
Yeah.
And they had to realize specifically that there was something wrong, specifically in the safety and security realm of ordinary life for South Africans.
Yeah.
So obviously, since they do have the large factories, the VW factory in the VW and Mercedes-Benz factory in which is formerly Port Elizabeth, now Gqeberha, the city of Gqeberha. Then they had the Toyota factory, which is somewhere here in the Highveld. The Highveld region is here between the Free State and Gauteng and North Transvaal. And if you have the factories already, you know that you are dispensing a lot of products into the market. This is not products coming on a boat from Asia. This is literally South Africa setting its industrial scene. So the banks realized, and the manufacturers realized, dealing with South Africa's safety and security scenario for consumers for their products is something that obviously you've got to take in consideration. Okay, there's going to be a high turnover rate. There's going to be crime associated to the vehicles. There's going to be some people that you train, like some mechanics.
Yeah.
There were stories in South Africa, and I heard some of them from my sister. Some of these mechanics were trained, and they would literally share with the hijackers all the, you know, nitty-gritties, the small details.
And how to quickly steal parts.
Yeah. Not the parts. Not car stripping. Car stripping is at the end. It's literally how to disarm the alarm system
and how to how to bypass all the security mechanisms that locks up or more like prevents unauthorized access, physical access into the car.
Now, here's one of the downsides.
Yeah.
My sister told me back then in South Africa, this is between 2010 to 1995, one of the most stolen hijacked cars were always these low-end consumer cars. So I'm talking about the City Golf, the Toyota Taz at the time.
I think
Was another one.
I think the Mercedes-Benz, the A-Series were also on that list.
Yeah, the Opel Corsa, the small Corsa, the Corsa Lights. Various other cars that had manual locking systems, meaning that didn't have a central locking system. You had to lock this door, you had to lock that door, this door, and this door individually. So it had these various particular security threats components. So now, obviously, when you look at an ecosystem like that, that definitely informs a risk element in terms of how to quickly flush this product in the system. But when you look at a house, you can't pick up a house and go. This is not the US where they've got trailer parks. There are billionaires, Helmut, in the US that have made money just from selling and renting out trailer parks in the US. And so and apparently it's also not one of the best housing schemes in the world, affordable housing schemes in the world, primarily because apparently these things are not, there are definitely banks behind it, but they're also not the answer to America's low cost, housing needs. So, yeah.
Actually, it's not just that it's not the answer, because I had no idea that there were, there's a lot of financial backing behind that type of housing scheme, if you can call it that.
I also just discovered it at the start of this year.
I mean, that makes it even more painful because, you can imagine people actually diverted, more like resorted to staying in their cars because houses were becoming more expensive.
Oh, and it's also a scenario of where you work.
So you just decide to monetize their alternative also, which is just, that's terrible.
If you have to look at that, for example, like the discussion on what we don't hear, meaning the information that you try to access digitally and even in conversation and even in reading or listening, is when we look at, for example, now I spoke about consumer products, right?
Yeah.
But our actual conversation is about,
the right to strike.
The right to strike, workers' rights to strike specifically. So in Namibia, it's a given that your right to strike is protected. It is protected. It's constitutionally protected. If there's any employer that tries to tell you you don't have the right to strike, you technically, inherently, you do. It's automatically there. However, it's very interesting to read, Helmut, that when the ICJ gave their particular summary on this right to strike that they had to assess. And qualify and satisfy, because I'll use all of them together, is that the interesting thing here was, I just want to open up the summary specifically. The interesting thing was that the UK and the US submitted written submissions to the court and then later on withdrew. Now, I won't particularly make any particular sort of like announcement on the kinds of leaders that are obviously in charge of the United States today, but they've also been known, throughout the US for not being the best at recognizing workers' rights. But the US, besides being the country that gave us the idea of the 1st of May and of, setting the working day as we know it today.
And yeah, 8-hour day, 5 days.
Almost 200 years later.
Yeah.
Can you guys believe it? Just as an interesting fact, the United States. And secondly, is also that they helped to set the particular indication specifically of doing away with child labor. They were setting the scene. The Americans, the American unions, and they were also the sort of like the country that founded the first labor unions. But the particular question that was posed to the ILO was one based upon Is the right to strike of workers and their organizations protected under the freedom of association and the protection of the right to organize convention? This is the question that was posed by the ILO's chief to the ICJ just to seek, and this was written in 1945, this particular article of the this particular statute of the ILO was written in 1948. Now, currently, was yesterday, our labor minister is in Geneva at the ILO's International Labor Conference, specifically. They are there.
Yeah, their headquarters in Geneva.
In Geneva, yeah. So the understanding, obviously, which you have to look at, not from a Namibian perspective, dear listeners, because we already satisfied that, is what has been the issue for countries around the world. Now, I have only predominantly heard of examples, for example, like in the US, Amazon workers which were doing their best since the COVID pandemic to try and organize themselves. The Americans, Helmut, if you go and read some of those things, they make up some, I mean, some painstakingly severe things. There is the Starbucks workers. So these two scenarios, they have one similar trait to them. So there's something known as union busting, which is an activity done by managers of the company to disrupt union canvassing of employees. Meaning, let's for example say Americans have the right to listen to anyone, ne? Mm-hmm. Ne? You can go and talk to anyone. But let's for example say you are talking to a union representative of the sector on the pavement, ne? Your manager can come from far, Hamut. He will see you talking to because obviously to make it understand for you in a Namibian context is that in Namibia, the union has to approach the business, the company and its owner to say, hey, listen, we would like to canvass for people your employees to work, to be our union members because there is no other union that caters for the sector. And we want to position ourselves as a union that technically represents workers. Now, here's a funny thing in Namibia. The business can say yes to recognize, but if there's no other union in that space, it also makes it a bit weird as to why the business would say no, not to recognize. Do you understand? Whereas it becomes weird, for example, let's for example say if you are a government employee of Namibia, you are automatically part of one of the two labor unions of the government. The only two the government recognize.
So by default,
even if you work for the state broadcaster, mm-hmm. ne, you are automatically, just by saying yes today, signing a contract, you would be recognized by that labor union. Whether you had a choice or not, which is one of the things specifically, which I also believe is probably against the rights of many government employees, is that they are told you must be represented by this organization and not given a choice anywhere else, which also makes things murky. Because if you've spoken to anyone else about this particular sort of like default template, it goes against one of the particular things in the Constitution, which is the right to a choice.
So it should be optional.
Technically, yes, Helmut, mm-hmm. because it's miss your money, it's miss your time, it's miss your skills. Yeah. You, the individual, you are going to work. You get paid for yourself.
You should be given an option to say no.
You should be given an option to say, hey, listen, I don't want to be represented by these guys because this is your track record.
So I want
to
be.
Or this is, or you are politically affiliated to the ruling party, or you are affiliated to that party, and I don't like that party's politics. So, technically speaking, mm-hmm. the government employees must have an option to select their own labor union of choice. It shouldn't be a default, only set down by who and who and who, which I highly suspect is probably the Public Service Commission, because the Public Service Commission technically is the one that technically appoints Namibians in the public sector. Mm-hmm. But as I said, I'm slightly digressing on that particular talking point. Now,
That's actually, you made two points that, that I would like to start from.
Yeah.
And One is why we are having this conversation, at all. And this is also why I started by asking the question of, yesterday the ICJ came up with this advisory opinion with regards to the interpretation of the 87's Convention on the right to, the right of assembly, but predominantly associated to workers, which is a piece of legislation that the International Labour Organization runs on, which is separate from the International Labour Organization's, constitution.
Yeah.
Now, the ICJ has that power to basically give that advisory opinion, according to the Article 96 of the UN Charter, gives them that opinion. They can the IOL is a UN agency. Basically, it falls under them. So that is that's basically within their mandate. So that's not the that's not a debatable part, or more like it's not one that will have an interesting conversation to have. The interesting conversation will start from the employer-employee relationship from a historical standpoint. This is where you see that, especially in the US and the UK, and this takes us back to the Industrial Revolution. Much of the laws that we have today are based on us swindling one another. I swear. Whether it's property law or contract law, constitution, we came up with the constitution because a bunch of families believed God gave them the right, only them, to rule.
Which cannot be proven.
All we had to do was trust me, bro. And that that form of governance ran for centuries.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then halfway through, we realized this is just this is a lot of crap. So now that's where you see when that's where we have the Athenians coming up with the democracy, which will later be adopted by the French with their excellent protest and rioting and separating the heads of monarchies from their necks. They were very good at that. So from there we have democracy, and now we have take for example basically constitutional republics comes from there. And property law comes from people trading in properties, swindling from one another, one of them being lying and misrepresentation. Take the phrase for example from the horse's mouth. When people were trading horses, I think mostly in medieval Europe, the people that were selling the horses lied a lot about the age of the horse.
Yeah.
So, until someone actually figured out that, you can get more information about, you can easily tell how old the horse is by just looking at the, the teeth. Into the horse's mouth.
It sounds very similar to the patent and latent, the laws on patent and latent defects in Namibia, where there's one specific thing. I think it's latent defects. You can't see with the eyes, but patent defects. I might be switching one of the two. The one you can see with your eyes.
The other
one you cannot. Or if you were adequately skilled enough to do your own sort of like assessment just by looking, you would have the ability of potentially, like you said, with the horses, look at the teeth.
Like,
or if it was a car, you would be trying to look, under the car,
look at all the parts and
structural stuff, and
looking good and which ones are clearly just a broken. Which take, for example, for an untrained eye, it will be difficult, if not borderline impossible, for them to notice all these defects. So that again, now we have all this, basically all the laws we have today are as a result of us taking advantage of each other. And labor law is an excellent example, especially if you could just start looking at it from Industrial Revolution, and we went through this. And it's a good thing we went through this before this topic, because during Industrial Revolution, employers were hell-bent on making money that they didn't care.
Regardless of safety.
They didn't care about the age of this individual. For the love of God, they had 5-year-olds in mine shafts who were losing their limbs. They didn't care. So, which is why that basically makes, and if you look at Africa in general, Africa's liberation struggle, liberation movements come out of what? Labor unions.
Well, I want to throw in a spanner into where we are also going with our discussion.
Uh-huh.
So one of the participants who submitted written submissions to the court, because everybody was given the opportunity to submit something. One of the participants is Business Africa. It's apparently this cross-continental African sort of like organization that represents represents businesses, private sector businesses across the continent. Now, okay, obviously getting through the fluff of the first three sections of their statement, because they've got a 35-page statement. Part three cites here Business Africa's position on the question before the court. Now, firstly, there's a sentence just above it that they make where they say, what is Business Africa's particular mandate? To respect the principles underlying economic and social order of every African country.
Mm-hmm.
Take that in consideration. Take in consideration, for example, with a country like what is happening today in Sudan and what is happening in Mali. Take it under consideration, Amut.
Yeah.
And the next sentence, to promote the principle of tripartism in the solution of social and economic problems in collaboration with governments and workers. So they put themselves outside and governments and workers have to be sort of sorted out between themselves, but they are in the employers. Then they get to the juice, the reason, the question. So they cite here, Business Africa's position on the question before the court. I'm literally quoting and reading. Business Africa's position on this question before the court is that the ILO Convention 87 does not protect the right to strike of workers and their organizations. The basis for that question is set out further below. That's now the following points after this, but I won't go into them.
Yeah.
However, at the outset, Business Africa wishes to emphasize that by bringing together representatives of governments, employers, and workers in its executive bodies, namely the ILC and the governing body, the ILO founders pioneered the multi-stakeholder dialogue that has substantially gained traction today at the continental, regional, and national level. I'll stop there for now. So, we then also have to look in conjunction with yesterday's talk of the, was it yesterday? The one about the African integration.
Yeah.
If we look at this, Helmut, a country like Namibia already has the right to association, meaning already protects the right to strike. And if you listeners don't know what we're also talking about, where they're cited from, we can also sort of like, you know, extrapolate the sentence that actually confirms that, because it was issued by the Executive Director's Office of the Ministry of Justice and Labor Relations. But if you look at a scenario like this, where embarking on the industrialization of the future for the continent, achieving the continent we want, striving for the modernization that Africans wish to achieve.
With whose money?
Good one.
Yes, always come back to
good
that
one.
Question.
With whose money?
With whose money?
Yeah, exactly. And with whose resources? With whose resources?
Oh, no. Look, when it comes to resources, especially the extractive, we have enough resources. We shouldn't be praying for miracles.
Oh, no. I'll get into the next thing. The thing that Bezos and some of the billionaires are now talking about. I think you've seen them already on social media. Bezos was saying, no, don't tax the low income households of the world. And I'm just thinking to myself, but you are championing AI that is going to take away the jobs, whereby the government won't have money to pay for services.
First of all, you are championing AI that will take over people's jobs, and you are a master at evading taxes.
Oh, yes. They discovered that that Musk and Bezos hadn't paid zero income tax for 2024. Yeah, both hadn't paid zero income tax for 2024. But they are number one and number four richest men in the world.
When it comes to, multinational corporations are notorious at evading taxes. They are very good at that. And this came out, I think, for the most part, when was that in the, it's one of those things that came out in Panama Papers. But anyway, the reason about why I believe this is one of the most important conversation to have, especially for ordinary people, is that labor unions have always brought people together. The, you know, you have labor unions, the whole idea of labor union, you know, at least in a way that we know it today, is, you know, it's a Western concept, but it's a very good one because it's one that brings people that actually understand the pain of a terrible working condition or underpay or being underpaid. They're just coming together to try to work their stuff out. Now, what do all companies have in common? And at least those ones that are established, they have standards of procedures where employees can actually channel their grievances through.
Mm.
Yeah, which is why you have your HR. But, yeah, for the most part, a lot of employees now find themselves, you know, resorting to take, for example, a strike. Because, and a strike for me, is you know, shows, at least that's my that's the first thing that comes to my mind every time I see people striking. The first thing that comes in my mind is that they have exhausted all internal mechanisms of dealing with the issue.
Mm.
Yeah, and they did not they didn't come to terms with their employer. And that happens.
Mm.
That happens, and that is also done in you know, that's also done by workers, and that's their legal right. Now, the thing about the whole freedom of association and protection of rights to organize convention 1948, that's number 87. Here's the thing. You have to understand that the ICJ knew at this point, it's safe to assume that they knew that if they don't make a ruling, which is very well thought out on this one, we're just a skip, hop, and a jump away from, you know, all types of gathering being placed under restriction.
Mm.
Yeah, because this is the right to strike, that's a gathering. And that's not just a workers thing.
Mm.
Now, that means if you, you know...
That could be a political rally.
Yeah, that could be a political rally.
That
even
could
though
be school kids.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, if you just make a decision willy-nilly and just put a ban on the right to, you know, the right to strike, you have to understand that the convention is an... the convention is called a freedom of association.
Mm.
Freedom of association. Like you just pointed out earlier about, you know... giving government employees an option. Maybe not a lot of them are going to use them, but to just prove the technical part of that freedom of association instead of just making it by default, associating them, whether they like it or not. It's sort of like trembles a little on their right to choose whether or not they should associate with the group that you are making them associate by default. It's a very interesting technical question.
No, it is an ugly technical question.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm so surprised that in the 36 years of Namibia's independence, that no government employee has asked this particular question. Why are you only giving me these two particular unions as the only options for represent? I mean, Helmut, how many times have you heard, except for the teachers, specifically in the public sector, just in the public sector, that how many times have you heard of the other government employees being unhappy? It has only been the teachers that have basically gone on strike.
Right.
Not even the nurses were that effective as the teachers, but it's just been the teachers.
That effective?
In terms of, you know, striking.
So the teachers are that good.
Look, I was this was 1998, the first time I heard of a teacher strike. I was still in Rehoboth. And the teacher who was my homeroom, you know, your main teacher, the teacher that you guys are assigned to,
your class teacher.
Yeah. And they were preparing for literally to strike there in the town.
Yeah.
At the end of the week, I think it was a Thursday, it was Friday. And they were coordinating all the teachers between each other across the town in Rehoboth, primary and secondary school.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, what's going on here, guys? This sounds exciting. But they were slightly nervous because obviously back then there were no cell phones. There was no WhatsApp. There was no way of communicating things just like in a private sort of like scenario in terms of private communication.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the teachers union back then literally had to work hard and going across the country. And the concerns obviously were, almost obviously what happens usually in such a scenario where communication infrastructure is not the best, it's easy also to spread rumors and gossip of potential shutdown, of potential retribution by the employer, which at that stage is the government. And look, I was just a 14-year-old teenager, but I was observing. We could potentially
you
go home.
One curious 14-year-old.
We could potentially go home. No, because we could potentially go home early.
That's everything.
That's the benefit of a teenager. We could potentially go home early. And I was like, yo, this is the life. But that was the first time. The second time, obviously, was the one that happened here in the 20-teens. The one that I heard about. And then ultimately the threat of now, 2 years back, before President Kanyiko passed away. The last one technically that was approved, the adjustment for the teachers. Now, in the broader scope of things, what factors into those particular industrial actions? Now, I'm just summarizing in terms of observing these time frames, is that there was a cost of living scenario associated to the teaching industry. For the public schools teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, facilitate that also in terms of the latest development that the Ministry of Education, that's now MESAC, has been trying to introduce with the bill that they were doing the public stakeholder engagements with, the one that we discussed last year, the one about where they're trying to sort of like professionalize the sector. And I really can't understand that, because professional technically means you are being paid for the job. So are they technically saying the people are not being paid for the job, Helmut? Because you're an example. You're my template here in front of me in the studio. You were paid your bush allowance,
ne? Oh, you have no idea.
Okay. Let's not reminisce, Helmut. But you were being paid for your bush allowance.
Yeah.
Or your bush salary, as I would like to put it also, because you were out in the bush teaching.
That place is awesome.
Not pushing. But anyway.
Lest the Minister of Environment shows up here. No, it was just teaching. People, not trees, so we're good.
Okay. Okay. Don't overshare.
Just to clarify.
So, just to factor in, just to once again identify what the ministry said back at the end of May, was that the ministry highlighted, although Convention 87 does not explicitly mention the word strike, the court, which is literally also what the Business Africa Consortium says, the court confirmed that the right to strike is an essential part of workers' freedom to organize and defend their interests. They continue. The ICJ's advisory opinion provides authoritative guidance on how the convention must be understood by all ILO members. And this ruling brings finality to a dispute that has affected the International Labour Organization for more than 30 years, which I did not know of. But it's a good thing. And a long-needed clarity to its supervisory system. For Namibia, the decision simply reaffirms what our own laws have already codified and guaranteed through the Supreme Law of the Land, the Constitution, and the Labour Act 2007, which recognizes and protects the right to strike. So, we've already got it.
Yeah.
But,
in other words, the point we are more sorted than some parts of the world.
But the other part I mentioned in terms of, for example, having the right to choice.
Yeah.
Of which union.
Freedom of association.
Yeah. Which union you would like to join is another discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I made mention of the union busting and the American scenarios of Amazon and Starbucks. Now, the private sector, Helmut, is also a little bit of a peculiar scenario. Because in the U.S., what I've heard in the U.S. specifically is that a lot of intimidation takes place in the U.S. scenarios. There was the
For union representatives?
Not just union representatives, but employees that wish to join unions. So this is the world, this is the country that speaks of freedom of choice, that champions freedoms like it literally is awards on a chest or medals of honor being displayed on a military jacket. But the first thing that they are denied is the freedom to make a decision about the employment that they are within. For example, factory workers in the U.S. highlighted, for example, in Amazon factories, well, it's not a factory. It's primarily just warehouses, Amazon warehouses,
mm-hmm.
that you can't have more than a minute of a toilet break.
One more time.
You can't have more than a minute. Okay, the minute is a little bit of an exaggeration on my side. But it's like within 5 minutes. But it's the moment you walk away from your station. Then the time starts. Until you get back to the station to continue, commence with your work. It's in that time frame. Now, it's either 5 minutes or 15 minutes. One of the two. Some people have said...
They don't have lunch, right?
It's also a floating principle in some scenarios. Why I say floating principle, because if you have to look at a business that runs basically around the clock, has yeah. overnight shipping, and tries to meet not just local but international sales, but even the local is also challenging because let's, for example, say it's a scenario of cross-country, and the United States is technically it's a country massive. That runs from ocean to ocean.
It's
Atlantic
a continent, they tend in a country.
Yeah, from Atlantic to Pacific, you know, it makes things challenging in terms of
logistics.
How the logistics, and also how do you manage the human capital that obviously works for you. And that's obviously one of the reasons why those warehouses obviously later on turned to automation and robotics, obviously to help it with it running its system.
The demands.
But the downside is always, you will always need a human to quality check.
Yeah.
Because something can happen to the machine. And something definitely always happens. It's yeah. either an electric surge through the power supply. It's either an arm or a lever or something wears off because of wear and tear.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's literally the conveyor belt system that just goes and stops and then... Everything backs up, the whole packages.
Yeah.
It always happens. With mechanics, it always happens. I'm there to I'm up for disputes, guys. You guys can come along. But I've seen what happens literally with a printer in our office.
Oh, no, it does happen.
I've seen what happens with a printer.
The ink
gets finished.
It does happen with your phone. It runs out of power. You have to charge it.
What do you want
to
do?
And then your charger is not working. You have to borrow your friend's charger.
What do you want
to go and buy another one?
What do you want to do, for example, Helmut? Let's say if there was a sudden interruption from NAM power supply to Windhoek. The whole Windhoek is off. And only a handful of businesses have a UPS, a backup power supply. What then happens? Huh? You know, certain things are literally out of the realm of control in some scenarios. If you're trying to still, you know, achieve every achievable dollar that you can make
mm-hmm.
in a sale. Now, in the US, things look weird. The UK is also a country of things that look weird. Now, the downside is that literally those two countries withdrew their written submissions. I wanted to read what their reasons were, but it's not there. It's literally not there. And in the broader concept, specifically, for example, from those two countries, if you are pro-workers' rights, in some scenarios, you are deemed a socialist, for example. That's why Bernie Sanders always makes the jokes, specifically if you go and look at the monopolization of the U.S. economy,
mm-hmm.
it technically is socialism.
Yeah, definitely.
It technically is socialism.
And the occasional bailout of multinational conglomerates, socialism.
It's definitely socialism. But it's your expression of yesterday. It's open market or free market economies. For the rest of the country.
Mm-hmm.
But for these guys, no, it's complete socialism. It's protection from the state and all manner of privileges that you would find in a privileged society, in a socialist society.
Yeah, but here's the thing. If you look at the resources that the two have in terms of, take your multinational corporations, and that are occasionally bail out every time that they gamble the general public's money and lose.
Yeah.
you don't have to be an expert to see that this is actually one of the reasons why labor unions are needed, because they have it upside down. They should be bailing out a mother who needs, intensive care money for their child and they can't afford it.
Mm.
Those are the people you should be bailing out. The people that, you know, someone that needs their asthma meds, but they can't afford it. Someone that has, kidney failure or all types of degenerative disease. Those are the people that needs bailing out.
Mm.
But now you are bailing out someone who is worth more than 5 developing countries' GDP combined.
Well,
how does that make sense?
Yeah, but Hamoud, here's the question of bailing out. And this has also been how the information game plays out. Now, I've observed, I'll be honest, I have been exposed to a lot of UK and South African and American, if I can say it, media narratives.
Yeah.
I've been exposed to a lot of it. And specifically when I transitioned over literally into becoming a media practitioner, is that the fundamental scenario is the realities that you are projected or that you are exposed to,
mm-hmm.
and the realities that you see around you. Now, I did not see the realities of how severe what do they call it? The Great Recession of 2008 to 2009, the financial crisis. I didn't see it in the US context because it was being, literally as you said, the banks were being protected. All we heard of was we had to see weird graphs that didn't translate to anything to a 25-year-old Dwight at the time, because I was trying to understand, what the hell is happening in the US? What is happening in the UK? How did this thing jump from the US to the UK to the EU? And then they were pinning it on rogue traders in the EU. The guy from, is it EDF? Or is it Societe Generale, the one of France's largest banks? No, EDF is an energy company. At Societe Generale, the supposed rogue trader. Go read up on that thing, Hamoud. How do you have a rogue trader? How do you give a guy, imagine there's a guy with a gun license. How does the police give a guy that the whole country knows has got an unstable psychological profile? Ne? And I'm just making an example, Nampol, please. I'm not busting you in any scenario, about this. It's just giving you an example. It's just giving an example to the listeners. How do you think would the whole country of Namibia feel if everyone knew of a guy who has an unstable psychological profile there, and the police still issue a gun license to this guy, and this guy owns 50 to 100 guns at his own place of residence? How do you think the whole country would feel about such a person? They would be up in arms. They would literally be exercising the right to association in front of that man's yard and in front of the police headquarters. Now, how do you issue a license to a trader, who supposedly is a rogue, but the homeboy has an office literally in one of France's largest banks at that time, and he's making trades? How do you call such a guy a rogue trader? He's got an office. Everyone sees him show up. He drinks coffee. He has meetings. He has clients. What was the statement? Now, I'm just showing you the exposure of the narrative, the media narrative.
Yeah.
If you, obviously this is now 15, 16 years later, I'm trying to get behind the discussions, listening to the neutral economists that I listen to, who are all academics, except for Gary Stevenson, who literally worked in the crisis himself,
mm-hmm.
is that everyone tells you, this was literally the socialism element that we mentioned a little bit earlier. This was literally as the central banks of these four major countries, that's now the US, the UK, the EU, and Japan, they knew of each other's particular financial activities. And then Gary Stevenson comes along and he says, COVID happens, and who do you think your government gives the money to? Okay, not in Namibia, because we didn't hear of this in Namibia, but in those countries, we heard about it. Who do you think their government gave money to? Their government gives money to the people that the government perceives will look after, out of the benevolence, out of the goodness of their hearts, they will look after the working class of the economy. They gave the money, and that's why Stevenson says it was the world's largest transference of wealth from government to private. And people were just given money like that, for example, in the UK context. He said it in the UK context, it was something like, was it 200 billion? Did the UK government just disperse like that over the 2-year period of COVID? Just like that, Helmut. PPE contracts that were, if you thought that there was a perception, for example, of weirdness in Namibia's PPE contracting, ne? The UK was even worse. In some cases, they were submitting contracts to the NHS for things that were never delivered. Literally, the medical staff of the NHS were exposed, literally, to more harmful exposures of COVID in certain scenarios. And this is literally people that literally just got the money, supplied something, didn't care what quality it was, and they're living it up. Now, there's nothing wrong with making money. There's everything wrong with profiteering. But it's obviously now another particular legal conversation about how do you prove profiteering and how trying to distinguish that from making money.
Now, let me just read something for you and the listeners about why trade unions will the right of association, as the International Labour Organization puts it. Now, that right of association where trade unions and the right to strike falls under, that's people basically gathering and, taking matters in their own hands in an attempt to solve their grievances, because when the systems put in place have proven ineffective. Take those rogue traders, for example.
Oh, and there was a guy apparently in the UK, but they never sort of like outed him. He was mentioned once.
Excellent. Now, if that was an ordinary person,
have employment contracts. They have employers.
There you go. Now, the 2008 financial crisis was caused by just Helmut and Dwight on the ground, would rot in jail.
Oh no, we would have French Revolution 2.5 here in Namibia, literally then Independence Avenue. They're on that four-way of Zubak, Sanlam building, the new FNB. We would literally be, I don't know who of us would be saying, let them eat cake, but somebody would be there.
I don't think we have cake.
We would be French revolutionized right there.
Yeah. Look, the point I'm making over why I believe trade unions are basically the right of association for ordinary people, which is, that's the same reason why I like civil society organizations, even though, just like any other organizations, they can be infiltrated by big money and be exploited to their own ends.
Yeah.
I'm saying those rogue traders, that is a sign of lack of regulation.
Definitely.
They were not rogue. They were not, No, they bribed you stop looking.
And do you know what was the answer, supposedly? The answer was that the UK and the US installs regulations that determines what bonuses these traders get. Remember, Helmut, if you ever listen to anything of Gary Stevenson will tell you, these are guys that get ridiculous amounts of money. If you go look at their professional conduct, last night they were drinking with the customer. They were high on all five of the...
All types of illegal drugs.
You even went with drugs. But let me say just substances. All kinds. Tomorrow that guy shows up and that guy has to make a decision of a multi-billion US dollars globally. How do you trust so much money with one guy? Now, knowing the conservative mentality in a Namibian context, I'm not talking about the guys that love being close to politicians, to seek the next tenderpreneur avalanche of any kind, or what other word can I, or the next tenderpreneurgenesis of any kind in Namibia. I'm not talking about that.
Yeah.
I'm literally talking about the banks working together, and they've got these departments that decides the whole global economy. You see, we don't have things like this in Africa, because South Africa is not that powerhouse like the UK.
Mm-hmm.
South Africa doesn't have a city within a city.
In terms of economic and geopolitical influence, the West carries a lot of that, which is why the decisions they make impacts all of us. That's one of the reasons why we are paying $15 for cab. It's because of a political decision that was terribly made between Tel Aviv, by Tel Aviv and Washington.
You even go with terribly made. It was a nightmare decision.
Yeah, it was a catastrophe. Now, the reason why I'm emphasizing the lack of regulation, which makes me believe that, take for example the whole idea of democracy or constitutional republic, whatever it is that you want to categorize it, that did not happen because royals were tired of ruling and decided to hand over power for
they were enjoying it.
They were having a good time.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for people gathering and basically asking all the necessary questions because they were at a disadvantage economically and politically, they would still be telling us that it was God that gave them blue blood, even though it was red when it came out, the power to rule. And that goes to show that, this brings us to Mark Carney, the Canadian Prime Minister's speech at Davos this year. Well, we live on a planet that has international, that's not equally applied.
Mm.
Yeah. Going back to, Anthony Blinken's, 2023 to 2024, Munich Security Conference.
Not the one of this year.
Yeah. No, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu.
Yeah.
That, unfortunately, is practically geopolitics and geoeconomics 101. On paper, everything looks very impeccable in terms of, impartiality and equal distribution of everything, the power money and all that. But practically, it's very predatory. And I knew that, but I did not know just how bad it is until you put it in that very nice, phrase, corporate espionage.
Mm.
It's bad.
No, it is bad.
Corporate espionage is worse than the military ones, because actually corporate espionage gives birth to military espionage and war.
Mm.
Now,
well, the Americans are pretty obvious of those things, them and the French, so we see it every day.
The right of the ordinary people to gather, is the only thing that have stood in between exploitation. It's how a lot of civilizations got out of exploitation.
Mm.
We have labor laws and anti-child, employment laws, because people basically stood up and gathered and went on strike. They did set a few factories on fire, which is why. But they had to gather. I don't recommend that.
Some blood was spilled. We have to be honest.
Yeah, some blood was spilled. Now,
some places.
Although back in, was that in the 1600s, the Dutch took it a little bit further.
Yeah, what did the Dutch do?
They ate their prime minister. They ate their prime minister. They say,
was this labor related, Herman, or was this just overall?
No, this was just some guy who was in office
for too long.
He
was trying to Museveni the Dutch.
Was that William of Orange? The thing is, Boy made a terrible decision in office when they went to war with the French, and then they lost the war. Now, a bunch of Dutch were not happy about that decision, so they decided to Kapana his behind.
You know, it literally reminds me of that movie that I watched. Oh, man, that movie was just heavy. But, yeah.
Look, the reason why I'm pointing out to this is every time that a bunch of people in high positions make terrible mistakes that cost people's livelihood, because that's what happened in 2008 financial crisis. It's because of lack of regulation. And this makes a lot of sense because for the most part, in most of these avenues or most of these business ventures, the people that are supposed to be regulating these institutions have business interest in the businesses that are making all these unregulated gambling behaviors. Mm. Now, and this is not something that takes place in 5 minutes or 20 minutes or 24 hours. This takes decades. Mm. The 2008 financial crisis did not start and happen in 2008. All the pieces that brought together that disaster has been happening for decades. Mm. And in the documentary called, you know, it's an inside job, which is just based on the 2008 financial crisis, but they really just do zone in on Iceland. And
The dispute between Iceland and the UK?
This is more about financial, opening up the market. That's basically what the Icelandics did in 2000.
It was a dispute between Iceland and the UK.
Uh-huh.
Because the UK told the Icelandics, yeah, we won't repay damages because part of the pensions, it was pensions, right?
Yeah.
The Icelandic pensions.
Uh-huh.
They were lost. The UK literally went, who was the prime minister? It was Gordon Brown. Yeah. No, it wasn't Gordon Brown. No, it was Gordon Brown. But anyway, it was a prime minister of the UK. Homeboy went and said, no, we won't pay back or we won't refund you or there won't be any course of, what is that other legal term?
Reparations?
Yeah, like some sort of compensation for bad decisions made. Because that thing, of opening up the market was that the Icelandics were just accumulating money on the island. That 200,000 people was just making a lot of money.
A heck of it.
And they were just saving the money because they've got everything for themselves.
Yeah, they did.
And then that situation happened in terms of opening up. The money was transferred to British banks. I think one of the banks was Lloyds TSB and it was Northern Rock was the other one in Newcastle. Lloyds TSB was at that stage UK's largest bank. Northern Rock was one of the second largest commercial banks of the UK. And then somehow, they were entangled with the US. Toxic, what do they call it? The toxic products, the toxic investments. No? What was the word they used, Hammond? Toxic assets. Yeah, the toxic assets of the US banking system.
Look, those guys, especially the UK, not the UK, the US credit rating agencies. Those guys came to the, after Iceland opened up the, quote unquote, opened up the market for foreign investors to come in and they started, bribing politicians left, right and center. Mm. They started, privatizing like three of their major banks that they had, that they had in the country. When they were privatized, politicians and, there was this increase in cozy relationship in terms of association and travel together, between business executives and political or public office representatives.
Mm.
Now, that's when a lot of things began to go south and people started going on strikes because they basically saw a lot of things wrong going on in the public institutions being privatized and the disadvantage that came with it, especially with regards to the ordinary Icelandic individual.
Yeah.
What that led to was, in the middle of all this chaos and all this gambling being done by the now privatized banks, American credit rating agencies came in and gave them the highest of the highest credit ratings. Like, you know what? These guys are top notch. They were top notch for the business and political class. They were not top notch for an ordinary Icelandic individual. And all this chaos basically piled up to the terrible economic, chaos that, and for the most part, an ordinary Icelandic citizen suffered after the 2008 financial crash. So, just a summary of it. In 2000, Icelandic government began a broad policy of deregulation. That's where it starts from, and all the anti-trade union movement, basically, especially in the employer sphere, taking place in the US, started with deregulation, and I think that sort of like reached its height during the Reagan administration.
Yeah.
In 2000, Icelandic government began a broad policy of deregulation, and that would have disastrous consequences. First for the environment and then the economy. The environment is important when it comes to Iceland because much of their energy is from hot springs.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of it.
It's not actually hot springs. The hot springs is one of the energy sources. It's literally, there's an active, like two or three active volcanoes.
The whole island is volcanic.
The more you go to the center of Iceland, it's literally they don't have much forests or trees. Even though there's this one weird initiative I follow on YouTube, who's trying to rewild parts of Iceland, but we also have to understand, it's things that happened here, even in Namibia. For example, if Namibians have ever gone here way south, down south in Namibia, you'll sometimes see that there are no trees in some parts.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's technically been one of the causes specifically as to the needs of communities to chop down trees. For firewood is the one.
Yeah.
Second, obviously, was for other arts and crafts. And thirdly, was to make your homes and to make kraals for cattle and livestock and stuff like that. So now these guys want to replant a plant species that was supposedly indigenous to Iceland at the time. But here's the thing: one of the issues is the soil. The second issue is also the climate of Iceland.
Okay, isn't volcanic areas more fertile?
The soil is more fertile, but It's a scenario of for how long had that soil been exposed without the tree versus now bringing in the sapling to replant now. Now, they've achieved a win, I think back in last year when I watched the first video, because that video was based upon 2024's performance. But when you look at the scenario, how Iceland solved its energy issue for the whole country, 300,000 people, it's literally the same issue that we as Namibians, we are breaking our brain cells about here in Namibia in terms of going like, but we are only 3 million people and why are we struggling? Even though recently, what was David wrote the article. I hope David had the sentence in its article where the CEO of ECB, Mr. Robert Kayemise, highlighted specifically the issue is also Namibia's geography. He is one of the few people that actually confirmed this, that rural electrification scheme that's part of the Ministry of Industries, Mines and Energy, one of the things that works against Namibia and bringing electricity at every spot to every person is because Dwight lives there in the bush from Windhoek. Dwight is not in Windhoek, but Dwight is there in the bush. But Dwight is calling for electricity to be pulled from Windhoek to there. Now, where must Dwight pay for that electricity?
Okay, look, one thing is we have a country with a very large landmass and we're just trying to use as much land as we can. But the thing is the infrastructure needed to connect all of you because factoring in the distances that that are between towns. Just take for example the distance between Okahanja and Oshivarongo, for example, and you have that gravel road that branches out and that goes to Okakarara. These are wild distances. Now you have
wild. Okay, yeah. How far?
I
think it's like close to 100,
Between Okahanja and Oshivarongo.
No, that's 200 and something.
You go. No.
And in the between, in some way there's Mr. Ogakara.
That branches out. But, our geography is one of those things.
No, Ogakara is on the other side of Ochorongo, on the way to Grootfontein and Tsumeb.
Okay.
Ogakara, they're on the other side of Ochorongo. They're not between.
Between Ochorongo.
There's another settlement between. There's like a whole couple between Ochorongo and Okai.
Must have seen a gravel road that just maybe that leads.
I think it's
Ovitoto somewhere
that you're thinking about.
Ovitoto, Ovitoto is right here.
I know, it's on the other side of Okahanja. If on your way to Ochivarongo, you get Ovitoto's turn off on the other side of Okahanja.
When last were you in Ovitoto?
I wasn't there. I keep driving past that place. I know two people from there.
You know. Okay.
Okay. I never got invites from both of them either.
Oh no, I got invite like several times.
Yeah.
Don't ask. The thing is, now the road that I have used to Ovitoto, I've never been to Okakarara, but Ovitoto, the 10 that that I've used in all the, I think 2, 3, 4 times that I've been to Ovitoto was the one that just right by Osona.
Literally?
Yeah, just right by Osona, this one that tends, that goes in a...
But then what's the distance?
If you're coming from here, and you are going, if you're coming from Winter, for example, and you're going to Okanja, where you have this road that, you know, that branches out on your left to go into this gated community of Osona. Just in the opposite of the road, just a couple of, not even 10...
Is it the one here at the Namwater?
There's one that branches out just right after Namod. There's one that branches out, on your right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That will take you straight to Vitoto. But you'll find one, you know, a couple of roads that branches out.
Yeah.
So you must basically know the place if you want to drive there. But the thing is, there are a lot of, obviously, roads. It's not just, it can't just be one road that leads into Vitoto. You can imagine there are several ones that takes you maybe to Krootfontein or Kanja and all those.
And those are gravel roads now.
And they're supposed such
a highly connected settlement, ne? Why doesn't it have tar roads connecting it?
I don't know how far that gravel road goes. The tarred road goes, that goes, to Vitoto. But, last time I checked, it goes, a little further, but, it reaches a point you're just hitting gravel road. Now, back to the whole, gathering, the right to gather or assemble or association in terms of, employment. The rogue traders, as they were labeled in that led to the 2008 financial, financial crisis. When you hear the term or the phrase a rogue trader, just think about a bunch of guys with a lot of money that they have managed to share with a bunch of politicians that are supposed to be regulating them. And this money must be so delicious, the politicians sort of like turned a blind eye on doing their job, which is regulating. Now, an excellent example of that, of why under-regulation is a terrible example, I'm going to use an Icelandic example because I don't have bodyguards. The Icelandic government began a broad policy of deregulation that would have disastrous consequences, and that's from the documentary of it's an inside job, in reference to the impact on Iceland of the 2008 financial crash. First, the disastrous consequences of the government deregulation of laws deregulation of Iceland would lead to the environmental and the economic consequences. They started by allowing multinational corporations like Alcoa to build giant aluminium smelting plants and exploit Icelandic geothermal and hydroelectric energy sources, which sounds like a good source of investment. The investment themselves, if you just look at this documentary, which was just put together by financial and political representatives from both the US and Iceland and the UK. This whole multinational corporations allowing them to come and build, to go to Iceland and build all these smelting plants and exploit the country's energy sources, which are green, is an excellent investment. The thing is, investments, foreign investors, this is the basic of understanding any type of investor relationship. If you don't have strong enough regulations in place, they are going to exploit. That's the first thing they are going to do. And that, I'm not bashing on your multinational corporation or foreign investor here. The point I'm making is the goal of a private entity is to make profit for its shareholders. That's the primary goal. If it means exploiting you to maximize those profits, they will. And they have done it. It's an open secret. All you just have to do is pick a book. And it's right there. And this is an excellent example. But now, well, or just tune into Home Run. Well, I can just well, I will lead you through it. So, many of the most beautiful areas in the highlands with the most spectacular colors were geothermal, aka, you know, Iceland is an island that's very volcanic. In other words, they're basically sitting on molten lava. The whole island sits on molten lava. So, and this is an island that's very small by landmass, surrounded by water. So this water reaches the reaches this molten lava and just, you know, generate all this you know, results into all these geothermal springs popping up everywhere. And the country basically harnessed that as a source of energy, which is, you know, it's a source of energy that is abundant for them in the very same way that Albania has a lot of surface water that they also they have also harnessed. And it's also to a larger degree, basically it's the same way that Namibia's strength, especially in terms of surface energy source exploitation, would be exploitation would be, you know, would be wind and solar. Because we have a lot of sunlight exposure and we have a lot of, you know, well, wind speed to basically harness in terms of energy generation. Now, pardon me. Yeah. So, nothing comes without consequences, the documentary puts, points out that, at the same time, the government privatized Iceland's three largest banks. And the result was one of the purest experience of financial degradation ever conducted. We have heard enough. How could all of this happen? Finance took over and more or less wrecked the place. This is just a narration. In a five year period, this whole opening up for the market and all the and building up of all these aluminium plants started in the 2000s. So fast forward to 2005. In 5 year time period, the three tiny banks, which had never operated outside of Iceland, borrowed $120 billion, 10 times the size of the country's economy. Again, when you don't regulate multinational corporations, get ready to see a lot of politicians get rich and a lot of ordinary citizens get very angry. It's a standard template that has been seen at the world every time investors shows up. The first thing they target is regulations, if you allow them. And I know one of the reasons why we don't want to put strong regulations in place in terms of regulating multinational corporations is because we don't want, you know, what do they call it, you know, capital flight. We don't want the investors to not invest in us. But no, if you have weak regulations, what you'll be looking at is exploitation, not investment. So now you have to pick between being, you know, it's either you regulate multinational corporations, or they are going to exploit you, and the exploitation is going to lead to a few very rich individuals at the top of political spectrum, and a lot of very angry people on the ground. But just to wrap things up, in a five-year-old, three tiny banks, which had never operated outside of Iceland, borrowed $120 billion, 10 times the size of the country's economy, shortly after being privatized. All three of them. The bankers showed money, the bankers showered money on themselves, each other and their friends. There was a massive bubble. Stock prices went up by a factor of 9. House prices more than doubled you have now a lot of representatives that political representatives in Iceland and the financial institutions that borrowed billions to buy up high-end retail businesses in London. And
do you see where their money went?
Exactly, straight
to the UK.
Now, bought a pinstrip private jet, a $40 million yacht, and a Manhattan penthouse.
A private jet?
A private jet, a Manhattan yacht, penthouse. And a penthouse.
in Manhattan.
Now, if you don't know what a penthouse is, I also had to Google it. That means you are too broke to know what that is. Now,
look, let's just say no, it's a flat. It's not. I see a penthouse. It's not even a flat. Imagine a flat that has, is it two or three floors sometimes?
Yep.
Imagine a flat that has two or three floors. A flat, people.
Now, imagine.
Not a house, not a freestanding house. It's a flat with three floors or two
now,
floors.
In the middle of all this chaos of privatizing three local banks, who each then turned around and borrowed $120 billion in U.S. dollars of foreign, of foreign currency, a million times the, the size of the country's economy. In the middle of all this chaos, guess what happened? Well, American credit rating agencies said Iceland was wonderful. And in February 2007, the rating agencies upgraded the banks to the highest possible rating, AAA.
So everyone was just going like, if this rating happens, everybody will flush you with money.
Uh-huh.
They will just throw money at you. Please borrow my money. Please, I want you to borrow my money. I feel like my money looks good in your pocket.
Second last. It went so far as the government, the government in Iceland started traveling with the bankers as a PR show. When Iceland banks collapsed at the 2008, at the end of 2008, unemployment tripled in 6 months. This started in 2000.
Mm.
And it ran until it was basically one terrible decision or one deregulation, one change in policy after another, one change in economic and political policy after another, employment policy after another, until 2005.
Mm.
Then the cracks began to show. 2007, to sort of like, to try and cushion people's concerns, they will give, your financial institutions, they are now private. They are not yours anymore.
Mm.
But now they are doing even better than they were when they were being managed by the public because now they have AAA rating.
Because we privatized them.
Now, I think that was a little bit of a false comfort zone that was created because from 2005, 2006, fast forward to 2008, they had a collapse. They actually, they're one of the countries that were highly hit by the 2008 financial crisis. In 6 months, unemployment went through the roof.
Mm.
Now, if you can think of it in terms of employment creation, this, it was just one or two multinational corporations, aka foreign investors that showed up to Iceland, build, aluminium smelting plants, and using the geothermal energy that Iceland has a lot of. That was an investment. There's nothing wrong with that.
Mm.
It's the lack of regulation that basically allowed them to go wild. And they did that.
Yeah.
And how did they do it? Well, all you have to do is look at what they did to the politicians that enabled them to do that. Bro had so much money, he was buying pretty much everything he'd set his eyes on. Yacht, penthouse, private jet. White is not enough. Just put it in, put some few strips on it.
Mm.
Now, one, regulation is central to it. Now, where regulation is not, where regulation fails, because regulation sometimes fails. And in that scenario, that's an excellent example of the systems put in place not being effective at what they were put in place for.
Mm.
That, if you ask me, is the reason why gathering and the right to association and strike, you make that illegal. People are going to gather anyway.
Yeah.
But then when people will be gathering, you will have a lot of different ways of technically describing what that gathering is. And that's how you end up with a riot and a civil war. Because people are going to gather anyway when they're angry.
Yeah.
You can make it illegal for them to gather, but when they gather, What happens now is to prove your point of the illegality, you send in the police. When the police are not working, you send in the army.
Mm.
And that's just a skip, hop, and a jump from a civil war.
Mm.
And no country wants that, no matter how, no matter your position as a politician in the Stingy Men's Association category. You want a peaceful country so you can steal, probably. I love politics. Now,
look.
As much as we like to blame, multinational companies, yes, yeah, they are to blame at some, at some things. But let's face it. The chaos they cause is a symptom of a much bigger disease we have at home. Credit Suisse was implicated in Mozambique. Arriva was implicated in, in Niger. Mm. Semheri was implicated in Fishrod. Mm. All these companies are European based.
Mm.
And all these companies worked with public representatives on the African continent to exploit their own people for personal gain.
And to subvert local laws. In every scenario.
That's how it starts. Yeah. They just
it always starts with the subversion of local laws. And in many cases, it's the ordinary communities that are the ones that are the whistleblowers. And that also cite and say, hey, listen.
Something is wrong here.
Aren't you a public representative? Don't you represent our needs?
And that makes sense because when the consequences come, they are the ones that are hit the most. Where you take the economic fallout in terms of employment of the of the fisheries scandal, you have fishermen that still don't have jobs.
And the particular discussion, because I also wrote that article, was it last year, in terms of the analysis that the IPPR guys did about the impact on the fishermen's lives, where they also brought forward took some of the fishermen that were impacted. And this particular concern, Hamid, if you look at it in its entirety, literally, this was literally industrial sabotage that took place, meaning people lost lives. People lost earnings and lives.
Mm-hmm.
And, this was a 10-year period of, the lives, the economic value not being also reported on. But the reporting takes place in terms of people that were shouting, hey, listen,
something is
going haywire in the sector. And then when you look at this particular discussion, this is one of the resources that is supposed to, like you also said at the start of our discussion, that is supposed to technically be the pathway to alleviate the inequality in Namibia, to give access to the opportunities to Namibians in society. But do you know there's actually a weird dilemma, Hamu, that pops up when you think that way, specifically giving opportunities now for communities and people of your overall national setup? Is if you give opportunities now to the generation now, you will most probably have to give opportunities again to the generations coming. Because even though, if I mentioned, for example, in the broader scheme of things, one of the reasons as to why many countries are experiencing flatlining birth rates is also that many of the young people are asking philosophic questions of, now, why must
I can barely feed me.
Why must I go to work if the earnings I'm going to get from this job is not even going to be able to cover my living expenses?
Mm.
And then you want me to marry, and then I must pay the exorbitant fees for medical facilities, and then there's the school fees for the child.
And I throw in Lobola in there.
Then there is convincing or literally paying off the parents, the in-laws, for the lucky packet person I'm going to marry.
Yeah, the uncle economy.
The uncle economy?
Yeah, they're the ones negotiating Lobola. I call it the uncle economy.
I don't know where this Lebola. Helmut, this Lebola situation is so weird. It's one of the reasons probably why I'm still not married, because when I look at things, I don't know the person standing in front of me if she's putting up an act. And
I'm sure she doesn't have the same suspicion.
The Dwight that's here today, isn't the Dwight of 10 years ago.
You
could still have conned me 10 years ago with whatever person, you know, you could put in front of me. And she would put on the act and I would just believe everything. But the Dwight today
is a whole different.
I will just call you a liar. Straightforward. I'll just go. And then the whole Lebola process is probably also out of the window. But then, it's probably verges close to a scam situation. Yes, you guys can also. We can talk on the street corner. Don't worry.
By we, he means him.
Yeah.
No.
So when we obviously view this discussion, this development, the cost of living is becoming an issue. Now, the strike, the right to strike, doesn't explicitly link into the cost of living discussion, but you can see in a way what this pathway leads to. You can clearly see where it potentially leads to. This means in the next coming 6 months, in the next 5 years, are we going to see more industrial action? Do you know why, Helmut? I made the statement a little bit earlier about this AI thing.
Yeah.
The right to have a job will start becoming a discussion, because now the governments, the politicians will have to explain to themselves and the electorates the discussion of, you were promoting AI here. AI is now doing the job of the 20 people that were supposed to be employed in that function or in that department or in those functions. Now Bernie Sanders, literally when Jeff Bezos and the other billionaires like Elon Musk, them were going on US national TVs and saying, yeah, don't tax people below a certain income range. And the government must consider a universal basic income. And Bezos is not saying, tax me more, because that's what's now the conversation happening in the Northern Hemisphere, the wealth tax conversation from Germany, literally to the Canada, to the US. That's the wealth tax discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And then the one lady I watched last night, the lady about the industrial revolution, about the AI, the House of L, is was her channel's name.
Mm-hmm.
L literally said, the downside of the argument that Bezos is making is specifically that Bezos is trying to deflect. He's saying, it's the government's issue. It's not my issue. And then he's now trying to put on an act of being supposedly a crusader for the working class.
How does he think the government makes money?
But he basically makes money from the working class buying his products.
Yeah.
Hence the reason when you and I did that discussion of OpenAI's report on the universal basic income, where they were suggesting a UBI, where you and I asked the question also then, now who's going to buy your products if people don't have jobs that fund their lifestyles? Where you get the money from for your product to be sustainable?
Exactly.
Now suddenly, Sam Altman's that report is now being reiterated by Elon Musk, is now being reiterated by Jeff Bezos, is now being reiterated by, what's Anthropic's CEO? The guy with the...
Hang on a second.
All these guys are parroting the same lines.
A bunch of guys that are billionaires and made a lot of money and also known for avoiding and evading taxes.
Are telling the government to institute a UBI.
The
American government.
Look,
the exact American government that went and slashed welfare programs.
That's not the worst part when it comes to the U.S.
Oh, man, that country.
This is the same. Trump just sued himself, settled with himself, and then put in place a clause that prevents further investigation on himself. Now, one of those, part of that investigation that cannot be investigated on him is the tax discussion.
Yeah.
So, in other words, I may or may not have stolen a lot of money. I may or may not have avoided or evaded taxes, but you are not allowed to investigate me according to, well, this settlement that I settled with myself after suing myself. At this point, Trump is making, you know, European medieval monarchs look very like a couple of angels. Now, the thing is, the irony is the people with all the money are telling the government to take care of its people. But what is the government's main source of revenue? Taxes. And the guys that are advocating for this are very good at avoiding that. And the question of who is going to consume your products if no one has a job brings up a question similar like that, but for politicians. Take, for example, wake up tomorrow morning and every job is taken over by AI. What will be the talking point in the next election? I will create employment for who? All the jobs are now with robots. Congratulations. Next point. I see that we have a housing problem here. If you vote for me, I will just bring all types of of housing initiatives to build affordable houses for you. Forget affordable housing. We can't afford food.
Yeah.
The whole job versus AI discussion is a very interesting one.
Yeah.
For both politicians and billionaires pioneering the technology. Caller, Eagle FM, evening?
Good evening. You must need platform, my friend. You must live. You must live. What's the chef? If you come down here, you plug it your tal.
Yeah.
Please don't plug so me. So today I was listening
to the platform. I'm sorry, is it the
as long as the person.
Okay, I'm going to.
You don't cut, Joe.
Please go on.
Not my language. Not my indigenous language be that one.
Yeah, I know.
Today I was watching the very interesting story, man. Just like what Dwight used to tell us. Sometimes, I think it was one of the two Sunday ago, if not mistaken, where we were talking about the culture of reading. The culture of reading. Oh, am I saying reading or reading now? You see, now
we're in Namibia again. Just go on.
So now, when they were now talking, this program was a integrational youth dialogue in South Africa.
Yeah.
When they were hammering on the indigenous language. So the importance of the indigenous language in terms of development. So now, and it was very interesting, actually, where people were talking about reading, the culture of reading, not only on this, using this phone that I'm using, of course, it can help us, but that urge was actually made to make sure that we visit libraries, we do all these things. So the culture of reading, I think, is if we are not inculcating that spirit into our children, in ourselves, I think we are going to find ourselves in problems. Seriously. So now you were talking about issues of, the benefits of employees and things like that.
Yeah.
So I came to discover the lesson that most of these things, especially when it comes to rules of laws and other issues. So, say, for example, arbitration process. That thing is actually, so people were complaining, I was reading in an article where people are saying, these arbitrators are coming from the Ministry of Justice and the Ministry of Labor, and how biased or how neutral can they be in terms of resolving problems? Because when you look at what Helmut was also, I think, referring to, this national labor relation board that they have created, and I think which is also in force here. So in terms of really bargaining, corrective bargaining, so people are really bargaining from the what do you call it, from the good faith kind of point, perspective.
Mm.
So before you even go out for these multinational companies, what about here? Because when you look at their conservancies and community members in the villages or wherever, especially in the rural areas.
Yeah.
So where you have conservancies established, and the, most of the time, people are, they are always disputes. It's not necessarily that they just come, but of course, because the community were not fairly represented. Mm. And even the people who are employed in those kind of things.
Mm.
Now, we are told the, all these kind of cases pending and all these other things. But now, which ones can we definitely use to make sure that people really get benefit? You know, you have Green Future coming, you have all these things. They all bring money here, supposed to bring money also on this our side. And we don't not read and get this kind of information. How do we survive, you guys, in this type of scenario?
Well, Angabona, you are right on the discussion of reading and information, because I recently also attended a particular, like a public discussion last week, where they also asked a panel, you know, looking at access to information as a human right. The human rights lawyer that was the cited, it is a rights-based discussion. The labor specialist that was the cited, it was literally a dimension of politics, meaning who gets the biggest benefit of the information, who has the biggest ability to use the information, so on and so forth. And then there was a government representative there that came and spoke about other things, but I will not divulge into that. But the main thing is sometimes, Angabona, is I will just summarize it in a idiom. The idiom is literally, if you can lead the horse or the ox or the donkey or the goat to the water,
yeah,
but if the animal doesn't want to drink, and not that I'm calling humans animals, but if you lead the person to the resource and you tell them this resource will help define certain things for you and make it simplified for you.
Mm.
If they don't utilize the information that emanates from there to navigate their lives from there, there's nothing you can do, Ankapona.
Yeah,
this now also does not mean that...
The responsibility still come to us. The responsibility is transferred unto you and to everybody else, because it's now kind of a brain game. I understand your concern, because they said the lack of information is the greatest poverty.
Yeah.
I was trying to understand that thing in a different context. And I came to understand more when you guys are giving us information, because you touch about the issues of laws, issues of economic, issues of media, all this kind of, it's an integrated kind of learning system that you guys are giving employees. But I understand, but the problem is that those who may be lacking this kind of information, they will blame it to who now? Not to themselves. Many a times when you hear some sentiment, legitimate ones, maybe it's because they nobody, I don't know, who can create that, you do not this kind of awareness and give them. I know you give us so much, like I said. I don't know. Who is going to be brave for that? Because somebody must be brave for that.
We'll always find someone to blame, though. That's
yeah.
The, okay, yeah. Oh, all right. Well, blaming will always take place, Angabona. That's the unfortunate thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but okay. And ultimately, the discussion is about where can people access information? How do they access the information? How do they access the conversations? Who do they participate it with? For example, do their parents also read? If there is reading, what do they read? And I'm not talking about a Bible, because a Bible is like 3,000 years old. So technically, the knowledge in a Bible...
It's a constitution. It's a Bible. I think it makes you understand a lot of things. Helmut, because of the time, maybe Helmut can also then just talk about, maybe in a minute or so, because of the time, about what we said, how people really benefit from this correct agreement. Because that principle of saying no strike, no lockout, and that means that in many of the agreements, so to say, they don't seem to have that inclusion, so that the people can also, yes, but even when it comes to the benefit that you trickle down to the people, you find out that people are just dodged, dribbled, those things, and then, but the laws are moving on, the school is not constructed, not even a soccer field, nothing. So how do you now, what do we do now in those scenarios, Helmut, maybe in terms of from a law perspective?
The good thing about us is, as a country, is like Dwight pointed out, we already have like we already have like a lot of mechanisms embedded in our legal system on the course of action of taking as an aggrieved employee. We have we have like the arbitration and the conciliation. You can go to the, to the labor court. You have the we still have trade unions that are thriving, which is why I believe we are in a much better position than a lot of countries that are basically deregulated much of their trade unions. So we have a lot of things to do, but we have it better in comparison to a lot of countries, believe me.
I mentioned when I came in, you are correct, but I mentioned when I started to saying that the arbitration maybe are they really partial enough, just to negotiate those things, because I understand that, yes, they could be, the recognition of bargaining agents, I understand.
Yeah.
But there are also those ones who are not, many of our, even in the informal employers there, informal employees. Many of them, they don't have, they don't have anybody, non kind of an agent that you can bargain apart from the one that is recognized, that you say now by law. But even those who are non organized kind of employees can also be represented by the arbitration, and I understand the cost and all these other things. So even in just through the negotiation, just negotiation before you even go to arbitration.
That's actually what's supposed to happen. I mean, that's why every company has the internal mechanisms of dealing with employee grievances, so that, because for the most part, when you show up for arbitration or conciliation, or, even in litigation cases, when you show up in court, the judge's assumption is that you tried all the, the human relations or social means of settling this issue, and you failed. And now you need a mediator. Yeah. So.
Thank you very much, guys.
Not a problem.
Thank you very much for having this thing. But unless it grow our language, as I come now, extract this language. As a Yemeni word in me. So it's a real
Ongangabona.
Cool.
Okay, sharp.
We quickly take a short break, dear listeners, for a quick live read. We'll be back right after this. Velvichi University's N2A approval for the expansion of scope. This is as Velvichi University is pleased to inform all stakeholders that the Namibia Qualifications Authority Council, the N2A Council, has approved our application for expansion of scope. This approval grants accreditation for the following NQF registered qualifications that are offered through full-time blended learning modes at our university. These are the Bachelor of Laws Honours, Bachelor of Education in Secondary Education Honours, Bachelor of Education in Senior Primary Education Honours, Bachelor of Social Work Honours, and the Diploma in Legal Studies Level 6. Velvichi University, where everyone is an achiever.
Velvichi University, where everyone is an achiever. 3 minutes into the hour of David. And the right to assemble, the right to strike is endorsed, or more like explained and verified, in case you are having any ambiguity. The International Court of Justice and the International Labour Organization are saying, there is no ambiguity there. Workers have that right. Have a good day.
And on that note, guys, enjoy the rest of your evening in our company. For the rest of the programming, we'll see each other again, same time, same place tomorrow.